Hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
Vince Masson.
Tim Phillips.
We should have practiced this, guys.
Yeah.
We needed
second time's a charm. Yeah. No, it's all good. We're just trying to get in sync. That's cool.
64 takes, and that was the best one.
Yeah. You could be like the Kubrick, you know what I mean? Keep taking.
Doing it.
All right, let's start again. Yeah. Rewind. No, we can't. We'll leave it all in. It's good to have everybody here, except Peter, who unfortunately couldn't join us. He started... the Christmas break early, but we will proceed because End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will not be a movie, but five movies. We are going to talk about our top five of the year because, you know, that's what you do at the end of the year when you review movies is talk about which ones are the best. Because, you know, we can't proceed without objectively ranking things. That's life in the biz for some reason.
And we already did our favorite Christmas movies last year.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
LA Confidential will always be a Christmas movie now.
Did we do another top Christmas movie special this year?
Or? No. You broke it.
Why, do you have some new ones to add?
No, I would like to refine my previous list, though. I do think that I was too, what do you call it?
Broad?
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I just remember Adam's face when I said LA Confidential.
I think that's the Christmassiest of your Christmas list, though.
I don't think I've seen that much disappointment on his face. He's like, can you name one Christmas thing about LA Confidential?
Beaten up by a candy cane.
Yes. Well, that's what you, I said, as
yeah.
I recall.
Hey, you did it. And it was a victory of sorts. And... we're going to give you credit for that.
All right, yeah. But, you know, if I could go back and throw Die Hard on the list, that I think would be okay.
Okay, well, we may revisit that next.
All right,
next
all right.
To begin with, how does everybody feel about 2018, the movies this year? Was it good? Was it tedious? Was it bad?
I didn't see a lot of new movies this year, so it's kind of odd me being here, actually. But yeah. I have cobbled together some lists of some new ones, but I liked what I saw. I guess I avoided ones that were considered bad.
That's always good. Yeah.
So that was nice, but I don't know. I just think in general, so much is just going more towards like Netflix and TV shows that it's tough for even me, who's somebody who likes to see movies in a theater. I'm not going out as much to see movies in theater, so.
Yeah.
It was kind of one of those years, but I heard there's a lot of good stuff, and I can't wait to see some of the stuff over the holidays.
It was a great year for horror.
Yes, it was. No,
spoiler the last alert couple of years. For my list, by the way.
Fair enough. Okay, then let's get started with the list. We only have 56 minutes left to get through.
Oh my gosh!
Four top five lists. Can we do it? Yes, we can. So why don't we start with the ladies? And the horror fans. See what comes up at top five.
Are we how are we doing this?
5-1.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So that's one. This is always the problem. Like I usually can figure out the top one.
Okay.
And then there's just like a mix after that.
All right.
So I'm gonna say I can't do 5-1. So here's
four,
number one.
All right.
So A Star is Born did make the list.
Okay.
Mandy, great.
Well, no, just one at a time. We're taking it one at a time.
You're getting overzealous here.
You're so eager.
I'll start with A Star is Born.
Start with A Star is Born.
Because it's the most recent one, and it's definitely not number one. And
fair enough.
That's it. That's as much as my list goes.
It's good enough to be top five, not good enough to be number one.
And to be fair, it's not in the horror category.
No.
Though it sure could be for some people.
Why? Because Bradley Cooper grumbling his way through.
No. That's the part that makes it like women everywhere should watch this film.
Okay.
Believe me, I've heard nothing but good things about Bradley Cooper's
grumbling.
Beard and grumbling. I'm sorry. Bradley Cooper channeling the sexiest man on earth, Sam Elliott? I mean... Or that, as one podcast I listened to called him a gilf. That would be a grandpa.
Yeah.
That you
thank
can
you.
Fill in the rest.
Yes.
Yeah.
That wasn't that hard to decode.
Yeah.
No. You're right. This is a horror now. Giving me a horrible like image.
But yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It was as good as I hoped that it would be.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Although I think it runs aground of sort of cliche the longer it is.
Yeah. I actually got into a slightly heated argument on the Hollywood Reporter Facebook page, actually, because there was a headline that said...
There's an expression you don't hear every day.
Yeah. Well, there was a headline that said Lady Gaga praises Bradley Cooper's risk-taking. And so I posted a comment. I was like, what risk-taking? He's telling a story that's been told like 3 times already. And people like jumped on me. Some people like supported me, I think. But that was my encounter with A Star Is Born for...
All right, Vince, why don't you give us your number 5?
Well, I would like to preface first by saying that...
Oh, good. There's a Vince preface.
Yeah. By saying that this list is probably likely to change anywhere in 2 to 4 weeks, I would say.
Granted.
I just haven't seen some of the things that I know I will enjoy, like The Favorite and, you know, Vice I'm going to see in a few days. So just bear with me. But my number 5 is actually Damien Chazelle's First Man.
Okay.
I had a great time with this movie. And, you know, I was kind of opposed to the idea almost. It did seem I don't know what the word is, utilitarian, just something that we had done that kind of didn't need any more exploring.
Sure.
But you realize actually how much sacrifice and work went into, you know, putting someone on the moon and why that actually mattered as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I thought it was great.
Cool. Tim, you're 5.
Okay, number 5 on my list. As I said, I haven't seen a lot of new movies. So it'd be similar to Vince where over the next couple of weeks, it'll be... Like last year when Shape of Water came out and Lady Bird, I was like, wow, these are a notch above. And so I expect there'll be other movies like The Favorite I'm looking forward to seeing. Number 5 on my list is something I stumbled on randomly on Netflix. It's They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
Ooh.
It's the Orson Welles documentary.
Right.
I watched the Orson Welles film, like the lost film that came out, The Other Side of the Wind. And I couldn't really make heads or tails out of it. It was enjoyable, entertaining, but a lot of hype went around it, like 40 years.
Yeah.
4 years after the fact they released the movie. And he was working on it for the last 15 years of his life. So the documentaries, actually, I find more intriguing because it's all about how he was focused on this film for the last 15 years. He thought it was going to be his big comeback. And then, of course, he died in 1985. But from, like, 1970 to 76, he was working on it. And it just shows, like, everyone thinks, like, Orson Welles is an outcast. But how plugged in he was with a lot of the young Hollywood, like Peter Bogdanovich and a lot of the young directors were all wanted to help him out.
Right.
And they had cameos in the film. So he wasn't as much of an outcast as his mythology would tell you. But... I thought it was interesting, and it really real good study on egos of directors back in that day, too, when everyone's patting you on the back, calling you an auteur and a genius. Just you don't get that as much nowadays. Like, people aren't as household names. There's the odd director like Quentin Tarantino or something, but back then they were all like these new geniuses, and they made great films, but I think kind of went to their head a little bit, too, when you can see that in the documentary.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's an interesting pick. My number 5 is Eighth Grade, Bo Burnham's comedy drama.
Interesting.
About a 13-year-old girl in her last week of eighth grade. It is just painfully awkward. It's like there's just like squirm-inducing scenes that are hard to get through, particularly the Truth or Dare scene, which a lot of people have talked about. But I mean, just even the opening scene where she's doing her YouTube video and every other word is like or or sort of. And it just feels so genuine. It feels so, you know, even though obviously I'm male, but I could read some of that awkwardness in her. I mean, that was very close to my 13-year-old experience, like trying to fit in, trying to find your own identity, you know, trying to be your own person, but wanting to fit in at the same time and, you know, be with the popular kids. But it's such a revelatory experience, I think. For those of us who didn't grow up with smartphones and social media, it paints a frightening picture of what it's like to grow up with smartphones and social media. And I think, there's a great message at the heart of it that, you know, a message of universality. We all go through this. What we experience is not unique to us. We all feel awkward. We all feel weird. We all struggle to fit in. And, you know, we should, you know, reach each other on that level. And it's the main actress in it, Elsie Fisher, is so great. Great young actress. I mean, and she was actually 13. Or she just had just graduated 8th grade. So she was 13 or 14. So she's in that strike range. So just a great film. That it also came from a guy who became famous through YouTube. So he kind of gets that side of it. And it was very surprising, really well made, and great film.
I'm sorry I haven't seen it yet.
You should check it out.
I know I wanted to.
Nor have I. Yeah, where
while.
Did you see this film? Because I haven't.
It's great. It's you can VOD it now.
Okay.
But it was I think it was at the Bookshelf in the summer, but yeah, you can VOD it. You can find it on any like iTunes, Google Play, whatever. Candace, number four, and it better be
all
a
right.
horror.
It is. It's Mandy.
Okay.
Which, this is a film that I did not see coming. I knew nothing about it. I hadn't even heard about it. It was I don't know how I missed it. All I got was a text from a friend saying, hey, this friend wants to go see Mandy. Do you want to come? And I was like, what is Mandy? He's like, oh, it's this horror film with Nicolas Cage. And I said, I am in. That's all I need to know. And it was just like, it was... I don't know. I'm pretty sure that I was actually watching footage from a film made in like 1979. It was just so incredible. Like the colors and the filmmaking were really, really great. It was two totally different films. Mm-hmm. Like it was one film at the beginning, which was kind of like lush and sort of like paranormal, lots of like fantasy type things. And then it became... Nicolas Cage revenge film, which is always good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always going to be good. And then there was just this weird bridge in the middle where it's just like, oh yeah, misogyny. That's a ugly, ugly thing.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was, I still can't quite comprehend what that movie was. Who thought, yes, let's do this. Who, like, it's just... Okay. It seems like such an anomaly.
You've sold me. I want to see that now.
It is great.
I heard it's crazy. Yeah.
It's a Greek director, so there's a lot of bizarre things coming out of Greece, I find. Okay. You've got Yorgos Lanthimos, who is the director of The Lobster, and now you've got this guy. It's like, there's a Greek new wave happening, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, there's also a Nick Cage sort of renaissance. Like, he's doing these smaller films because he had Mandy. Yeah. There was also the one whose name I can't remember where he's like the owner of a motel. And it's like there are like back passages in the hotel he discovers where he can sort of watch the guests. I can't remember the name of it. Robin Tooney's in it too, but
there's a name you don't hear very often.
Yeah, she's good. But yeah, it's it seems like Nicolas Cage is having a bit of a comeback. Hopefully, because he's a talent.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Vince, you're number four.
Well, my number four is Widows, the Steve McQueen movie, which unfortunately we never got to review. I will, again, apologize for that. But if we did, I would have said that I thoroughly enjoyed this movie, which I did. And Steve McQueen is a very interesting director as well, because I think if you look at his early filmography, it kind of has a very kind of slow, kind of artful, you know, he's a painter as well, or was prior to being a filmmaker. So it's like every frame of his movies kind of looks like a painting, you know, even 12 Years a Slave in some ways kind of does. But then he came out with this like heist movie. I hate to like kind of box it in as a heist movie because it's actually, it's got these kind of like very interesting themes about, you know, political corruption as well. Colin Farrell's like really, really good in it. But great performance by Daniel Kaluuya again.
He's intense.
Daniel Kaluuya. And just carried on the back, I think, of I think it's Viola Davis.
Yeah.
And she has just an amazing performance. But just a lot of energy and kind of action that you don't see Steve McQueen normally doing. And I love this movie.
I loved it, too. It almost made my top five. It was definitely in the top 10. Elizabeth Debicki, too, in that.
Yes,
she doesn't get enough credit. 'Cause her stature. There's a scene where she's at the gun show and she's like towering over everybody there.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful, and it uses her really, really well.
And very kind of unconventional script as well, Gillian Flynn as well. So just a great, whether or not it'll be nominated for all these Oscars, I don't know, but it is just like a great, solid kind of thriller.
It's solid. Yeah. Definitely solid. Tim, you're number four.
Number four for me is Deadpool 2.
Okay.
quite enjoyed this film. I as much as the first one, I think. I just love the irreverence, the fact that the movie just doesn't give a crap. You know, it's just like, whatever. You know, and sometimes it almost, the plot almost just falls into itself kind of thing. But it's pretty awesome, the fact that, it's a superhero movie that's just really not taking itself seriously like a lot of them do. And it's just, what can I say? I just thought Ryan Reynolds was really good in it. I would nominate him for an Oscar again that he won't win, another one. One he'll have no chance in hell of winning, but yeah, I love when they do that and just give some credit to a comedic performance. But
I don't think that movie works without, or either of those movies work without him. Mm-hmm. I think he makes it. It's one of those perfect blendings of character and actor.
Yeah.
Sort of like how Tony Stark is like Robert Downey Jr. And even if you read the comic books, they sort of draw Tony Stark to more closely resemble Robert Downey Jr. and sound like Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. So I feel like that there's that effect on Deadpool too. And I think, in 10 years we'll still be talking about Ryan Reynolds popping up in things as Deadpool. If there's sort of one thing that's going to survive Disney absorbing the Fox X-Men movies, it'll probably be Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. My number four pick is very much like Deadpool 2. It's Lean on Pete, the
interesting
the boy and his horse drama, which is it's so heartbreaking.
Now, there were two horse dramas this year,
you're
wasn't
right.
there? There's The Rider, and then there was Lean on Pete.
Yes, you're right.
And I was in the library the other day downtown, and I had both of them on my hands, and I went for The Rider. So I'll have to go back
wrong,
for...
Apparently.
You chose wrong.
Lean on Pete is...
I didn't see The Rider, so I can't say definitively you chose wrong.
I have
But you
either.
Chose wrong, because Lean on Pete...
Didn't even see it.
Sorry, Guelph Public Library. Yeah, appreciate it.
But it's the lead actor in it, Charlie Plummer, is so great. It's like this boy who's just trying to hold on to anything. His life is constant, sort of this turmoil. His dad's thoroughly undependable. His mom's long gone. He lives in kind of like a hovel. His dad is, always on the brink of unemployment. And he becomes connected to this racehorse. And, of course, the racehorse is not in his prime. So the owner, Steve Buscemi, ends up selling him. And then the kid breaks and goes on the run with the horse. And it is so – it puts you through the emotional ringer. And by the time he gets to the end and he finds his aunt, and his aunt says, like, oh, you can stay here as long as you like. And just, like, the emotional reaction of, like, him finding some – safety and security, it's a tearjerker when he wakes up his aunt in the middle of the night. He's like, is it okay if I stay here for a little while? And she's like, yes, of course. And he's just like, okay. And it's so heartbreaking.
It's an exhausting film.
It's an exhaust. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Spoiler
in a good way.
Spoiler alert, it's number one on my list.
Okay,
so
all right.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was just a great sort of like slice of life, but really following this kid who has no other options, just his desperation, like he just has bad luck after
bad luck
through it all,
and
just watching him travel across the country just with his horse, great landscape photography, and also just showing like how they both are struggling, they both need food, they need to get there, desperation,
right,
looking for that long lost aunt. It's it's quite the story, and there's some good supporting performances too. Steve Buscemi and Chloe Sevigny are in it as well.
Yeah, Buscemi's really, really good.
Yeah, it's a really good movie.
So you chose wrong.
That's what I heard.
Well, that's the great thing about the library, man. I can go back and choose right.
The library gives you second chances. Yeah.
Lean on Pete. We'll be waiting
exactly.
for you.
Assuming I don't return the rider late, you know, I can have another stab at it.
All right. Number three.
All right. Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. So, unlike Mandy, I did see this movie coming. But like Mandy, I went in going, I have zero idea what this film is about, because of course that's sort of the way they did sell it, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly, you know, the trailers certainly let you know the pastiche of the film,
yeah.
But that was basically it. And so I was ready, because Drew Goddard is great. The cast, I mean, there's not a single person on that cast that I wouldn't go see on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not disappoint.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. It's exactly the type of thing I really like too, where it sort of plays with the narrative, like we'll tell a little bit of this and then a little bit of that and a little bit of this. And in the end, even if the story had been told all sort of chronologically, it still, I think, would be a strong enough story just to tell like that. Apparently misogyny is also a little bit of a horror and misogyny. Good years for both, or bad years for, I don't know how you want to say that.
Depending on how you look at
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I will say that Chris Thor. Chris Thor. Yeah. Chris the Thor. Thor the Chris.
Yeah.
Hemsworth was... he was so good. And it's funny because, of course, he was Cabin in the Woods was sort of his first sort of big starring role, which is also a Drew Goddard film.
Yep.
They sort of, you know, discovered him before he became like
Thor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it's just so great because he is such a good actor. And I do think that Thor actually, we really do see that, right? The first one, the Kenneth Branagh one, it was, you know it's going to be a well-acted, well-done.
Mm-hmm.
The middle one was a little disappointing. But the last one, you know, again, we got to see what Hemsworth can do. And something like this, where he is not a likable person.
Yeah.
But my God, do you really, like, you're just, like, so drawn to this character and watching him.
Yeah.
He's really, really incredible.
Yeah, there's a great scene in that movie with Cynthia Erivo. Good year for her. So it's the first year in movies where they're having a conversation, and she says, like, there's nothing that you can say that I haven't heard before.
So
and
good.
He goes to say something, and she says nothing and shuts him down.
I know. I was just like, I can we stop right here so I can just cheer, because that was so powerful.
It was really great.
I don't know. I saw that this movie was like 2 hours, 45 minutes. It didn't have like that great of a score online. So I don't know, man. Like
you got to find your taste with this one,
right,
I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I saw it and I don't know. My wife loved it. You loved it. Adam mm-hmm. loved it when we reviewed it. But I was kind of disappointed by it. So I'm kind of like the alien in the room. But I liked what it was going for. I found like it was very inspired by like Quentin Tarantino, that sort of thing. And it was cool. I liked the score. I liked the singing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Cynthia...
Erivo
was the best thing about the movie, I thought. Chris Hemsworth as the cult leader is interesting. In a dark way, like Jim Morrison meets Charlie Manson kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to watch because it's so against what
it's
other
against
characters...
type, yeah.
Against type,
yeah. Because he's sort of finding feet as a comedic actor, too.
Yeah.
But this is not something he's played before, which is like sort of villainous.
Yeah. I just found it was, I don't know. I just found it was a little underwhelming.
Fair enough.
That's me.
Yeah. No, you're wrong. There's no right answers. There's no right answers.
Except on the
but you're wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
Vince, what is your number three?
Well, my number three was a movie that I saw actually quite recently and thoroughly enjoyed. It was Peter Farrelly's Green Book.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, some much has been made about how kind of maybe embellished or what's another word I'm looking for?
Embellished.
Manipulated. Yeah. The real story has been, but it's like, I know, I get it. Okay. It's like, it's a really kind of topical, very like, very touching kind of story. You know what I mean?
Right.
And Peter Farrelly, I was kind of shocked. It was like when I heard Adam McKay was doing The Big Short. It was like, whoa, where did this come from? You know what I mean? But yeah, just so obviously this guy played by Viggo Mortensen, you know, is kind of a rough and tumble kind of Italian whatever bouncer type.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's going on
roughneck. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Another great performance by the great Mahershala Ali.
Yeah,
playing Don Shirley, who is of course the real pianist, and their characters kind of clash. You know, it's kind of a classic road movie, and then over the course of the trip, they kind of get to empathize with each other's perspectives a little bit, and it's just a great kind of funny, hilarious movie, actually.
Yeah, I was watching or rewatching the first season of The 4400, and Mahershala Ali starred in that, and it blows my mind that like it took him this long for somebody to discover he's an awesome actor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that we've discovered it and that he's working fairly steadily, and he's in the next season of True Detective.
Yeah.
Actually.
And even his role in Moonlight was like it was mm-hmm. great, but I don't think kind of exemplifies how good of an actor he is, actually.
Yeah.
I think Green Book actually is a better
showcase. Yeah. Yeah. Tim, number three for you.
Number three is Ernest Saves Christmas.
Just a couple of decades
the most,
off.
Most underrated Christmas movie of all time.
All right. No, okay. That was an odd choice.
Yeah, that's. I watched it for the first time this year.
Deadpool too. I don't know.
But yeah, I saw it for the first time this year. So.
Oh really? Okay. Interesting.
No. Number three, I put Isle of Dogs.
Okay.
I really enjoy that. It's Wes Anderson. It was just, what can I say? I just thought that it was a really sweet movie. I'm not a dog owner, but it made me kind of wish I was. It was a really sweet movie, and like if you are a dog lover, you'll just love that film. Yeah, the whole premise that the dogs are deceased and they're sent to Trash Island is really really good at showing how this group is outcasts and how they're trying to find their way in society. I thought it was really interesting, really funny. And then the voices too, I just think like Edward Norton, I just find him really funny. Whether it's live action or voice acting, just hearing his voice, it really calms me and makes me happy. So I would say that I really enjoyed Isle of Dogs for those reasons.
It was fun. I don't think it exceeds Fantastic Mr. Fox on Anderson's like and stop motion oeuvre, but it was a fun movie. I'll say that. My number three is Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón movie about semi-autobiographical about his childhood and his nanny as a boy. It's been almost 2 weeks since I saw it. I haven't really been able to stop thinking about it. A lot of it feels improvised because the way he shot it, where he'd give like the actors a page of script at a time, but also the actors themselves aren't necessarily experienced actors, so it has this improvised feeling, but at the same time, you know, the composition is so purposeful, it's so planned and thought out. It's this really wonderful both versions of, you know, sort of filmmaking. From a technical standpoint, it's just excellent. I know Peter had some issues about, you know, the story of a poor little rich boy and his nanny. But I found that at least this movie had a point of view and didn't do what like a lot of Hollywood movies do, which is sort of glam up the idea of the domestic worker. Like it showed this woman Cleo, like her job for all like the good moments where they treat her like a member of the family, and all the bad moments where they treat her like garbage. And I think that makes it like a step above against something like the new J-Lo movie, where she's, you know, blue collar and stumbles into, you know, white collar job, and, you know, J-Lo.
Made in Manhattan. Is that what you're describing right now?
Roughly explains about half of all J-Lo movies. Except maybe Out of Sight and Anaconda.
That's a good double feature right there.
Yeah. Triple feature of Made in Manhattan, too.
Oh, true. And Alfonso Cuarón is a very interesting director because he's been doing that for a while, actually. I think going from kind of bigger budget stuff to kind of more personal stuff. You know what I mean? Like, he did Y Tu Mama Tambien, which was obviously, like, very kind of raw, like, handheld improvised, like you were saying. And then, you know, did Children of Men in 2006, shortly after that. So he's very...
He did Harry Potter in between.
Oh, true. Yeah. Just that little low-budget thing.
Little low-budget Harry Potter. The best Harry Potter, I think.
It is the best Harry Potter,
I
think,
keep hearing that. I haven't actually seen that particular Harry Potter, but... So it's weird. I also saw Roma very recently, and I feel like I actually loved it, but I feel like it would have been disingenuous for me to put it on my list because I haven't had time to, like, process how good it is. You know what I mean? I need to, like, watch it again. So to just, like, slap it on this list and say some, like, good things about it, it just didn't work for me. It just – I'm sorry.
That's what I did, too. I slapped her on my list. And
right. Okay. And now we're going to – we're going to hear your phony praise.
We're going to talk about it tomorrow.
All right.
Well,
that cues
up the second half of the show nicely. We're going to take our musical break here and come back with our top two. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Nothing left to say, and so good night. How do you propose to make this investigation?
Well, I've established contact and created some familiarity with the Klansman over the phone. I'll continue in that role, but I'll need another officer. Surprise, surprise, a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
That's my point exactly.
Chief, Black Ron Stallworth. Over the phone, white Ron Stallworth face to face, so there becomes a combined Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
I believe we can. With the right white man, we can do anything.
With the right white man, we can do anything.
I'm sorry, that's white man.
Yes, I foolishly pronounced the H silently. But that was a clip from The Black Klansman. It was a Spike Lee movie that came out this year. And it
Just Black Klansman. Drop the.
Is it just the?
Ooh,
is it just Black Klansman?
That's great.
Yeah. I thought it was the, or maybe the book
is
the.
I think it's just Black.
The book is the.
Yeah. I think it's Le Black Klansman.
Sorry.
Pardon my French.
How can we add more semantics to your?
Tim has the Quebec movie poster.
Yeah.
But Black Klansman is my number two. It's hard to think of a more timely movie. Not only because Spike Lee kind of bashes you over the head with it at the end with Donald Trump and what happened in Charlottesville in 2017, but this is a bizarro Spike Lee movie. It hits all his high notes, but it's got comedy, it's got great performances. John David Washington, who is of course the son of Denzel Washington, longtime collaborator of Spike Lee, and Adam Driver as well. I think a lot of credit should go to Topher Grace as young David Duke.
Oh my God.
It's and like the I wasn't a big fan of all the like the montage of like white supremacy in 2018 at the end of the movie, but I think the scene sort of at the end of the second act where you had Harry Belafonte talking about the real life lynching of I think the man's name was Jesse Washington.
Yeah.
And when he's juxtaposing that with the Klan meeting and David Duke talking, that's powerful in its own. And it's also, it was just this past week that the United States Senate passed anti-lynching legislation, which makes you think, geez, like 2018, we're finally getting around to anti-lynching legislation. Cool. But it's just perfect timing for the movie, perfect material, perfect marriage of director and material, and I think it was surprising all around.
Yeah, I also initially wasn't a fan of the kind of montages, but then I was like, yeah, that's just Spike Lee, though, man. He's just he's a director with such passion and such energy. He needs to kind of do that stuff, you know what I mean? So I just kind of took it as like, that's just Spike.
It's just what you get when you watch Spike Lee.
Fair enough. Anyway, we're going to continue on with your number two, Candace.
Sure. I'm just going to throw in a quick honorary mention that I removed from the list, which was Hereditary.
It really should be
on my top five, but I just felt like I needed to make some space for something a little bit outside of Hereditary. Also, because Hereditary was a super strong three quarters of a film, and then I like, that's all right. It was pretty good. It was all right. But like Toni Collette, like it was really, really incredible. But I did choose to push it off a little bit to add some other things. So my actual number two is Black Panther.
Vince is shaking his head.
I know. And it's weird.
I'm about to start wagging my fist.
Of course, it's weird because, you know, I'm constantly the one going, good Lord, can we please stop getting so many superhero movies? I'm so tired.
And yet here you are.
I know, right? Not only here
it's
I am.
It's always the ones you least suspect.
Did I only go see it twice? I might have seen it three times. Who expects to cry at a superhero movie?
Certainly not Vince.
No,
I cried because it was over. I was like, oh, thank the Lord.
Listen, if you don't like Hamlet or other Shakespeare, don't watch Black Panther. If you don't like The Lion King, don't watch Black Panther.
Thanks for telling me that after I paid to see the movie.
But yes, so I did. I mean, it is just... it was a great film. It was an important film. I thought I cried one out of sadness at one point. I also cried out of joy, really, in seeing this like beautiful representation of Black culture, you know, the Afrocentrism. And I was just like, this is just so it feels, I can't tell you what's different about watching this versus watching some white made film that shows.
Yeah. Like,
you know,
Thor.
Tribal dancing, that sort of thing. Yeah. But I'm like, something about this feels beautiful and joyful as opposed to feeling really exploitative, which it has in other things. And so,
and the most complex, and you have to admit this, the most complex villain these Marvel movies have ever put out.
Which isn't saying much, I would say. Okay. It's still some like cardboard.
Until you think about Thanos.
I don't want to think about Thanos. I've had enough Thanos.
I don't have to.
I agree. I'm so tired of Thanos. Good choice.
Okay. Purple people eater. No thanks. Well, Vince, if you think you can do better for number two.
Well, you know what? My number two was Hereditary, so she's already said everything about this movie, so she did my job for me. We can skip to Tim.
Excellent.
So... Candace is just ruining your whole day.
Yeah. Well, she made my job a little easier. She said everything about Hereditary, I guess. Yeah. No, this is Hereditary, like, came out earlier in the year, and it started to get some, like, buzz, and it was kind of,
you
know.
It was at Sundance, wasn't it?
Yeah. Limited kind of release. And so it was something that was on my radar. But then when I finally got around to seeing it, it was, it absolutely blew me away, I have to say. And that's very hard to do, I think, with horror now, because they're so formulaic now. There's always some generic, you know, exorcism scene at the end where the priest comes in and does some, like, absurd exorcism. There's none of that. Directed by this guy, Ari Aster, who is a graduate of the AFI film program in California, which is obviously a program that is, you know, trying to usher Hollywood filmmakers into the Hollywood system. And this is like so... not anti-Hollywood, but it's just very unorthodox for, for that kind of thing. And I think, so I appreciate his approach to that a lot. Can't say I totally understood the plot 100%, but some of the images, like I actually disagree about the ending. Like some of the images were totally like haunting and kind of unforgettable. I actually bought this movie on DVD last week, so I'm looking forward to returning to it. But that's my number two.
All right.
Yeah, I certainly agree about the imagery at the end. It is very shocking and stays with you. And I think if it had been a horror like that the whole time, I would really, really like it. And it's just, it felt like it just suddenly sort of switched from a really intense, horrifying film about grief and what happens around that to an exorcism movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, I felt like it built to a climax. Like it slowly kind of built these things up, and then the ending had a very good climax where everything kind of comes together. It wasn't sprung on the audience, I feel, in that way. But yeah.
Well, you guys can settle
way,
this after the
show. It is a great film. Yeah. And everyone should see it.
I agree. But I'll just walk out with 25 minutes left, right? Is that
no, even like 10.
10 minutes? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you have to see it to like
to know when to walk out.
Yeah.
Tim, give us your number two so we can move on.
Okay, number two is Roma, which you've already mentioned.
Right. Yeah.
All I'll add is the lead actress. I thought she was amazing, and she's not an actress, so it's very interesting. Harkens back like Italian neorealism, where they'd have the, you know, I think like bicycle thieves. It was a factory worker who. He just, you know, it was a very haunting performance. And this one, too, was, and just shows the skill of the filmmaker, but also this woman who, like, the camera's on her for most of the film, right?
Yeah.
And she's really carrying it in a lot of ways, even when there's a lot of other secondary characters involved. And I thought it was really, really interesting. You could really feel empathy for her character. And I'd like to watch it again, like others, because I've slapped her on my list right now, having watched it like a week ago. But I'd like to watch it again, and just
I would definitely like to watch it again too. And it, one of the things I found compelling about it was how much empathy is created for her, considering that there's really no close-ups. Which is one of the things, one of the filmmaking tricks you're taught is, you know, to if you want to feel the emotion for your subject, you do the close-up, you focus on them.
Right.
But most of the shots are middle shots or long shots in the film. So the film sets up this thing like you're very standoffish. You're like observing everything that's happening, but it very much sneaks up on you just how much you feel for this woman.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, another filmmaker may have gone straight to the close-up because there's some emotional moments where, but you just feel it because it feels more natural, the fact that it's taken at like medium and long shots. It just feels like you're more part of this environment as opposed to, you know, right in the face of the character kind of thing.
Well, as I said, my number two is Black Klansman. No the.
Unless it's on the book.
It might be on the book.
Yeah.
So we're going to go to number one.
Number one. Woo. So.
appreciate the woo.
It's probably no surprise to many people that my number one is A Quiet Place.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That film was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. The score. Just, I spent days listening to the score afterwards, and I had sort of forgotten because when did it come out? It was like April. Yeah, it was early in the year, and my Spotify gave me my, you know, sort of playlist of top songs, and there were three songs from the score on my list. I was like, oh yeah, and so I've now been listening to the score again quite a bit. But it was just, it was great. It's really interesting to me that two on my list are actors who have turned directors. So John Krasinski and Bradley Cooper both directed these films and starred in them, which I think is a really challenging thing to do to begin with. And to be able to do it well, also put in a good performance, is like a lot of work to me. And what I love about this film is that despite the fact that it's a horror film and it's set in this horror genre, it is 100% just a film similar to Hereditary. It's a sort of a film about grief and communication. And I will say it right now that I will not watch A Quiet Place 2. I have no interest in it. I don't need to know any more about the world or the things that are there, what happens after, what happened before. I'm a little concerned that it's been announced and that John Krasinski will be in it, which also concerns me for reasons. And I'm like, this film was just so perfect the way it was. It was a great story told. It was a complete story, and I don't need any more.
It could be a 28 weeks later situation. Because I wouldn't have thought that a sequel would have been necessary 28 days later, but 28 weeks later has its moments.
It's been so long since I've watched it that I'd have to...
Okay.
I don't know. Just on the note of... And I'm sorry to be a Grinch, okay? I really am. On the note of, like, actors turning directors, I don't think it is as admirable as people think it is, okay? Mm-hmm. You've got Bradley Cooper. You've got his DOP, Matthew Labatique, okay, who is already an Oscar-nominated DOP. It's like you're not starting from ground zero like a lot of other filmmakers, okay, where you've got to, like, work out. You know, people in lower.
Right.
You've already got a DOP that's been working for like 10 years. So is it that hard for you to go, hey, bro, what lens do you think I should use on this? I don't think it is. I'm just saying, yes, it's admirable that they make good movies. I don't think it's as difficult or as admirable as people think it is, though.
Don't worry, everyone. Vince will tell you at the end of the show how to get in touch with us.
Yes, exactly.
To be fair, I do agree that the triad of an amazing film is director, DOP, editor. Those are the people who make a film, and
this is why Orson Welles wanted to give John Toland like a credit on Citizen Kane, because he was like, this guy was like half of the directing force. You know what I mean? Like, he really like was part of this direction. So don't discredit the other experienced crew members that are working. Yeah, Bo Burnham. Like, do you think that guy could have directed a movie without a skilled crew? Like, I don't think so.
I mean, what's Martin Scorsese but his DOP?
Wait, what?
I said, what's Martin Scorsese except his DOP?
No, because he started with, like, you know what I mean? With nothing. Yeah, shoestring budget. He did everything himself. He proved that he had the...
And it was excellent.
He wasn't in A Star Is Born back
I'm
in the
just
70s.
Saying. He didn't... Yes, yes.
All right.
That's all I'm saying. Again, I'm sorry to be a Grinch, but I have to put it out there.
Well, you're such an expert, Vince. Why don't you tell us what your number one is?
Well, my number one actually is Black Klansman. When I think about the movie that I had the most fun with, that I was entertained the most by, and that kind of, for one reason or another, that I was just thinking about the most, it has to be that movie. Mm-hmm. I think, in a weird way, it's a culmination of everything that Spike Lee has been doing, the same way that Traffic was kind of the culmination of everything that Soderbergh had been doing. Mm-hmm. And the humor, I think, like the tone of the film, I think is what really does it. Because you have to be kind of funny, but you can't be too funny about subject matter like this. But you also can't play it totally straight, I think.
Right.
You have to have some comedy when you're dealing with something that's quite frankly, this absurd.
Yeah.
He literally just picks up the phone and calls the
David
KKK. And it like kind of goes from there. You know what I mean? So there has to be some comedy. But the script is so well done as well. You've got this kind of side or subplot with him and this kind of romance that he develops with, I forget what her name is, but she's the leader.
Is Laura Harrier.
Okay. Yeah. And then simultaneously, he's kind of investigating David Duke and the KKK and Adam Driver as well. It's just he has a little bit of like an arc there, you know what I mean, when he says to John David Washington, it's like, I never used to think about this, you know, race stuff, even though he's Jewish. And he's like, now I think about it all the time, now that I've kind of gone undercover with this story. So just a fantastic movie.
Number one for Tim.
Number one is Lean on Pete, which you mentioned earlier.
did a bit of foreshadowing earlier.
Yeah, it was good. I agree with everything you said.
Okay, good. I like that.
Ditto.
Ditto, yeah. I just thought it was an excellent portrayal of poverty in America, mm-hmm. physical and emotional exhaustion. Mm-hmm. I thought the lead actor was tremendous, Charlie Plummer, mm-hmm. no relation to...
the plumber.
Christopher Plummer.
Yeah. The Canadian plumber.
Yeah, no relation to that plumber. He's a plumber from a different mother. But I thought it's an excellent movie. It takes its time. It's so unlike a lot of films you see nowadays. Kind of harkens back to just sort of that character-driven story. Mm-hmm. And I really was rooting for him to find his aunt. And... yeah, it was really, really interesting. And you're wondering, like, what time does this period, does this take place in?
Yeah.
I remember when we were reviewing it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting at the end, you kind of, like, figure out it's not when you think it's taking place. Because this kid has, like, no access to technology or anything the whole time. It's just him and his horse. Very interesting. I would say it'd be the better horse movie, having not seen the Rider.
Right, okay.
But I think you should go with Lean on Pete.
All right, thank you.
All right. My number one is Three Identical Strangers, which is the documentary about the triplets who were separated, adopted by three separate families. One of them goes to college, where people start identifying him as one of the other triplets. He finds his brother, thinks they're twins, and then another one sees the story about them in a newspaper, and lo and behold, they're actually triplets. And all this is revealed in the first 15 minutes of the movie, and you think to yourself, okay, well, where does this story go from here? Well, it goes into maybe a bit of the notoriety, how they were on Donahue, and they had a cameo in Desperately Seeking Susan. And then it's like, okay, maybe this is about like how you have short-term fame, like going viral before going viral was a thing. No, it is actually much darker and much more interesting than that, because it turns out they were part of an experiment. How do twins and triplets get reared without knowing that they're twins or triplets? And it was this bizarro psychological experiment, and it's incredible. It's an incredible story with incredible implications, and this was like 1960s America, not like 1940s Germany, when you'd associate that kind of stuff with Mengele. This was like kind of close to home, and it's just an incredible story, and it was really well told with a lot of reenactments and really like emotional interviews, because there's also implications about mental health and things. So it's a really powerful movie.
So not the Mr. Rogers documentary.
You know what? The Mr. Rogers documentary and the RGB, Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, I mean, they're both good profiles, but this is a fascinating story.
True, okay.
I think people know about Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it was going to be like the revelation that Mr. Rogers was a sniper, that urban legend that he was a sniper in Vietnam or something. But like if that was going to be confirmed, I think that would be one thing, but... well, we got to wrap that up. That is our top five of 2018. And if you want to hear that again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. We are on Facebook at endcreditsradioshow and on Twitter at endcreditsradio. And we'll go around the room quickly and where you can find everybody at various intersections on the internet, especially Vince. But we'll start with Candace.
I am on the internet at sin48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8.
I'm
they're all waiting for the hate mail. It's
hey, send it my way, bro. I'm on Twitter at vmassin5.
All right.
And also on Facebook, if you want to just look up my name, Vincent Massin. Feel free to do that as well.
I'm on the interwebs, Flash in the Deadpan. You can find it throughout, or Tim Phillips, which you won't find because there are millions of Tim Phillips. So try Flash in the Deadpan.
All right. And I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find my political stuff at GuelphPolitico.ca. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next week with Worst of the Year and things we're looking forward to in 2019. And Happy New Year, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Happy New Year.